Welcome to Money Grows on Trees.
Money does grow on trees.
A podcast full of practical, real-life money lessons that you wish you learned in school. Lloyd is a former lawyer turned lifestyle entrepreneur. In each episode, he'll be answering the tough questions around money, investing, and entrepreneurship to help you transform your money mindset and move you closer to achieving your financial goals. Now, let the class begin. Here's your host, Lloyd Ross.
All right, welcome back to the show, Money Grows on Trees podcast, and I am sitting here with none other than my mentor, the OG mentor, the man who taught me the most in life, in business, raised me, and we're sitting in the middle of Service Paradise. You can probably hear some of the hooligans going past here in the daytime. We're here on a Saturday morning sharing a Johnny Walker together, and it's none other than my dad. How you going, Dad?
Really good, mate. Really good.
This is good.
It's fantastic.
We're on the podcast. We're in Service Paradise at your office. So around us, you've got Hilton Hotel. We've got the Chevron Renaissance. We're right in the heart of Service Paradise where Dad's office is. And we've been talking about doing this for a while.
We have.
And we haven't. Now we're here. So
you like my new outside office?
Yeah. You've got a little outside office off the just like... It's this little beautiful little cove, and we can see all the buildings and the trams going past. So you might hear some background noise, like you might have heard the tram go past there. You might hear some people who are still out from last night. But I think it's fun to be here, you know, outside where we catch up ordinarily and do this.
I think it's a great spot. Great to do it here.
And it's nice to have a scotch because, you know... It's we'll loosen Dad up a little bit here on the podcast. It's his first real episode. I did one with him before, but my microphone was no good. So now I've got a mic, we're good to go, and it's Dad's first podcast.
Looking forward to it.
All right, so this episode with Dad. It's going to go over probably four. I don't know how many yet, but it's going to go over probably four parts. So it's a four part series. So Phil's going to edit this for us. He's going to drop one part per week. And we're going to go through, we're going to unpack Dad's story and his life, and we're going to draw out all the wonderful lessons and things that he can share with you guys to help you with your money, to help you with your success in life. And we're going to talk about some fun things that he's done in his life. So I've got to say to you guys, buckle up. It's going to be great. Dad's sitting here next to me going, oh my goodness, what are we going to talk about here? But so here's what I want to do first, Dad, before we go roll into those episodes, just to loosen things up a little bit. Let's do this. I've put down a few quick fire questions here. So I'm going to fire these questions at you. You just tell me quickly what you think, or just so everyone gets a bit of an idea who you are, right?
All right. Good. Sounds good.
So, cat or dog?
Dog.
Dog. Okay. Summer or winter?
Summer.
Summer. Favorite motorcycle?
Oh, geez. There's a lot of those. Harley Davidson.
Harley Davidson. Harley Davidson what?
Fat boy,
Harley Davidson, fat boy. We'll circle back to that in the story. Favorite car?
Aston Martin. Probably Porsche, really.
Porsche. Favorite car is Porsche. Yep. There you go. Favorite food?
Ooh, geez, favorite food. Wow. I like a good roast baked dinner.
Roast baked dinner, there you go. Meanwhile, we just had a half a Devon and onion sandwich together here. Split it up. We just had a Devon sandwich, a classic Australian sandwich for lunch. So anyway, all right. Favorite song?
Well, that'll be a song of Elvis Presley's.
All right, any song of Elvis. So you're gonna answer the next one. Favorite musician?
Elvis Presley.
Elvis Presley. There you go. Favorite holiday destination?
Oh wow, Le Meridian Hotel in Thailand.
The Le Meridian Hotel in Thailand. There you go. If you haven't been there, go there. It's a cracker destination. Favorite drink?
Scotch and Coke.
Johnny Walker Red.
On the rocks.
On the rock. On Coke with ice. That's Dad's drink. He's been drinking that for as long as I can remember. Okay, here we go. Shares or property?
In the first part of my life, property. And the back end of my life, shares.
There you go. Great combination. And of course, last one, favorite child?
I have four. I'm lucky to have four.
Oh, mate, that's a trick question. So I'm one of four siblings, so there you go. All right. So there's some quick fire questions. You get to know a bit about Dad. And so now, let's go back, Dad. I want to take everyone back to, so what's your current age now?
I'm 65.
So 65, and what year were you born?
1957.
Okay, so take us back to the first parts of your life before you really got into business, before you were successful. Tell us, what was your childhood like and your first jobs and that sort of stuff?
Well, my childhood was a good childhood, and I, you know, was a happy child until my father was killed in a road accident when I was 8, and that changed my life a lot. And it was probably the awakening, so to speak, at that point in time in my life with the tragedy, that the loss of my father. And from there, I knew that I had to, really get on with my life a little more than, I didn't have that father influence in there any longer as the breadwinner of the family. I started my first job when I was 10. I used to sweep floors at a nightclub in early hours of the morning, and my mother didn't know I was doing that at the time, but it was a way of generating some pocket money and my little way of contributing, I thought, at that time. And I continued to go to school. I enjoyed school, played a lot of sports, played football and cricket, basketball. I got into motorcycles, started racing motorcycles when I was in my early teens, and I was having probably a pretty good, nice life. My first real job was an apprentice plant mechanic, heavy earth moving equipment with the Main Roads Department. But whilst I was doing that job, also had another job pumping petrol. And when I'd have my annual holidays, I'd go humping roof tiles. So I was sort of pretty keen to make money and have a good life and do the best I could for my family and the future of my own family.
So you left school when you were 15?
I did.
And you did your apprenticeship, is that right?
Yeah, I did, for 4 years.
So diesel mechanic apprenticeship?
Yeah, I did. And I wasn't real good at it, but I completed it.
So, when did you figure out you weren't good at it?
Probably the first day I started.
First day, there you go. You never finish out what you start, right? There you go. So dad's out of school, into his apprenticeship. First day you started. So how old were you then?
15.
15, okay. So at that point, you said you had three jobs. You're doing that?
Plant mechanic, diesel fitter, yeah.
Pumping gas at the petrol station?
Petrol station, 3 nights a week.
3 nights a week, and you were roof tiling?
Roof tiling in my annual leave holidays.
Okay.
And weekends.
And just so everyone knows, this is in Tamworth, New South Wales, the town of Tamworth. It's a country town. It's more famous now, but back then it was smaller. But this is in a country town, New South Wales. So dad's got two sisters. And his father passed away when he was 8. So this is the beginnings. And so I think it's important to say, why did you work so much?
Well, I wanted to, when my father died, we weren't a very affluent family and we struggled as a family. And I didn't want to struggle all of my life. So I decided the only way to do that was to work hard and work diligently and work as many jobs as I possibly could.
So you wanted to just improve your lifestyle, your standard of living.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And what would you say, that was driving you in the early days. So, and you got into racing speedway motorcycles.
I raced short circuit, motocross and speedway. And I went to England hoping that I could carve out a career in motorcycle racing. But I really just didn't have the firepower, didn't have the money, didn't have the ability either.
So just so everyone knows, speedway is basically where you're riding motorcycles around a dirt track and they got no brakes.
Correct.
Right? They got no brake.
One gear, no brakes.
So you can do, you're on YouTube some speedway motorcycle racing, you can see what that is. So how old were you then?
18, 19, 20.
18, 19 and 20. So in his late teens, so racing speedway. So you went to England.
Yeah.
And what was that experience like when you were in your teens?
I had a lovely time in England. I went to apply for riding for a club called Bristol Bulldogs. And but there was a lot of people in those years that were speedway riders and the competition was fierce to get a ride. And you really did have to have, the right motorcycle and have the money to be able to do it, full time on a professional basis. Which was a little difficult when you really don't have those funds.
Yeah. Okay. So at what point? So you ended up you went overseas and you left your apprenticeship, so you didn't want to become a diesel fitter, or you didn't want to continue being a diesel mechanic. And so you went to England, and when you came back, how old were you when you come back?
21. Just, nearly, 21.
Okay. So that, did you know what you were going to do?
I think travelling, living in England made me really appreciate just what a good country Australia is. The English were very friendly, and I made a lot of good friends in the time that I was there. But also, it's a very harsh climate, and it's a harsh place to live. And it really did make me appreciate Australia a lot more. And when I did return to Australia, I returned with, you know, I was a different person, and I certainly had a lot more zeal in me to do well in life. And I wasn't going to just settle for average. You know, it wasn't in my makeup. It's not in my DNA. I just wanted to be successful in life and do well in life and have the nice things in life that, you know, success brings. Live in a lovely home, drive nice motor cars, travel the world, and you know, really make it a worthwhile life.
So where did that come from for you? How did you learn that? What was the driver there?
I think the driver there was, you know, I had some growing up, some challenges, but I also had some good people that really put me on a good path. When I was 21, I joined the insurance business, and when I joined that insurance business, that was also an awakening time for me, because it was my introduction to the world of sales and marketing. And in those days, I had a sales manager. His name was Vic Hatfield, and he was a tremendous mentor to me. And another chap that worked in the insurance business that I was associated with, his name was Vernon Lewis, and he was very instrumentally a mentor to me as well. He taught me the business principles of how to run a checkbook, and as basic as that might sound, because I really didn't have any of those sort of skills in business at all, because I'd come from a working class family, I'd been in a working class environment, but I had never been in a business environment. And being in a business environment is a lot different when you start to really, you know, fine-tune yourself in life. And naturally at school, you know, we don't learn how to run balance sheets, or we don't learn how to run a checkbook, or, you know, the things that are fairly important instruments in your daily life.
What you're saying, school didn't teach you business, school didn't teach you about money, school didn't teach you much else, but probably how to read and write.
School taught me how to read and write and be able to, you know,
maybe socialise.
Socialise with other people, and playing lots of sport, you know, helped a lot too, because, you know, I'm a team player, and I played a lot of team sports, and naturally, you know, in business, that's a pretty important thing too, to be able to bring those team sports skills to the fore in business.
So let's just unpack that a bit, because we've gone a bit fast forward to insurance. So that's just, what I want to know is, how did you go from coming back from England, probably not much money, and at that age, I'd imagine, how did you go from that to becoming an insurance salesman?
Well, it was a step in between. I got a job with a company called Gestetner. And Gestetner, they were mostly providing a machine that was in schools. And the old Gestetner machine, it sort of really started my sales career, because I'd go around to the schools and introduce myself and do a demonstration of how and what the Gestetner machine would and could do. And then they would put it into the school over a trial period, and then I would go back and follow up and make sure that the machine was working. And I'd go back on the basis that I was going to take the machine out, and they wouldn't let me take it out because they got used to using it, so they would then fully buy it.
So you didn't have any sales skills, you didn't have any business skills. And so in between, from when you started, we came back from overseas, you went to into an insurance business, you needed to obviously get some experience, I imagine. They wanted you to have some experience in selling, or face-to-face something or other.
Well, yeah, I guess that it was really, you know, all selling is about being personal, and I was a pretty happy person and pretty personable, and I was young and I was enthusiastic, and I think that came through, you know, in my job interview for that position. And then when I did get around the schools, I could relate to a lot of the school teachers, because, you know, I'd sort of grown up with school teachers around my life as mentors, I suppose.
Yeah.
So that helped me a lot, just being back in that school environment, in terms of, you know, those sort of people that I was used to being around.
So Dad's selling these Gestetner machines to schools around country New South Wales, and you were saying to me one time that you got in the car and you went to drove to Newcastle, picked up the machines instead of waiting for them to come to you.
Yeah.
Went out to the school, so you went out to see the teachers. You just said that you put them in place, give them a demo.
Yeah.
And then you go back to see if you take it from them, and they said, no, we need to buy it now. So you're kind of showing that they needed it, really. You're solving a problem for them, really, which is what sales is at the end of the day, isn't it? Solving problems. So what was that experience like? What did you learn when you're starting out doing Gestetner machines, driving around to schools?
I learned how to drive a lot of miles.
Yeah,
and break a lot of windscreens.
What do you mean?
Well, break a lot of windscreens. The roads were pretty terrible in those days, and there were lots of trucks on the roads. And you know, I'd be from one town to another in the middle of the night, driving and getting ready for the next day in that particular centre where I was going to be working. And I'd bust a windscreen at 1 o'clock in the morning, and then limp into town, you know, slowly, and get the car repaired. And while I was getting the car repaired, I'd be out around talking to the school principals and people who are making the decisions to put the Gestetner machines into place.
So just so everyone knows, in those days, I think that the glass windows in cars weren't plastic like they are now. They were actually glass.
Yeah, they were. Yeah.
So what Dad's saying is he would drive around at night, a stone would hit the glass window and it would shatter the glass in the front. And so he'd drive around with a broken glass window. So it wasn't pretty. It's not a pretty... When you first cut your teeth on something, it wasn't pretty, was it? You were doing miles. There was no mobile phones in those days. Probably having a cigarette and listening to the radio on your way in between schools?
Driving, you know, from one town to another of a night time did give me a lot of time to think about a lot of things and about my life and about the things that were important to me and the things that I was planning to do in my life. So, you know, there's not much else to do at 2 o'clock in the morning driving along the highway.
And so did you know, like, what... So you want to be successful at that point because no one does those miles and does that if they don't want to be successful. So did you know you were going to succeed?
I always knew I'd succeed because I was determined. And determination, you know, is... And I always had the courage. And but I was inspired, you know, with other people that I'd watched over my life.
Who was inspiring you then, do you think?
People were inspiring me who were successful in the world of business. Okay. I watched other people in the insurance business, and I noted the cars that they were driving, and I noted the homes that they were living in, and I noted the, you know, the way they dressed and things like that. And that's something that inspired me to want to be able to achieve the same.
So rather than you noticed that the insurance business looked to be a profitable one. People were dressed well, driving nice cars, and instead of you throwing rocks at them, you know, and having tall poppy syndrome, you were inspired by them. So you wanted to kind of be, you know, lift into that and aspire to be better and greater and more successful rather than the opposite of...
Yeah, Australia, sadly, sometimes over the years has had that tall poppy syndrome, I think. And I've noticed it as I've travelled around the world, the different attitudes. Sometimes, you know, Australia's probably evolved in more recent 20 or 30 years than they do now, probably... become inspired from successful people. But back in those days, if you were successful, there was a lot of tall poppiness about it, and there's no question in those years, because people, you know, weren't used to people doing well in life.
Yeah.
And I think there was a game changer in about 1983 when Bob Hawke became Prime Minister of Australia, and he and Paul Keating, his treasurer at that time, they floated the Australian dollar, deregulated the financial markets. And for the very first time, Australia was competing in the world on a world stage. Some months later, I think it was September, I remember Australia too won the America's Cup. And on that occasion, there was, from memory, there were seven races, and Australia won the last race ahead of Liberty, the American sailboat, and beat it by 41 seconds. And that was the first time that the America's Cup was ever lost by America, and it was won by Australia in 41 seconds of that last deciding race. And that really, for the first time, put Australia on a world stage, and even the Americans started to know where Australia was and that it did exist, because it was a significant time in our heritage.
So that the impact of that, obviously, is the fact that then it opened up big businesses like insurance and different sales roles and... And the employment in Australia would have changed a lot, you know, and the opportunity would have definitely changed then, yeah, in the early 80s. This is, we're talking about in the early 80s. So let me ask you this, Dad. So you're going from a Gestetner. How did you get a job as an insurance salesman?
Well, that was really difficult because the insurance industry at that stage didn't really give people opportunity at the age, unless they were a minimum of 25 years of age.
And you were 21. Yeah,
and
right?
I was 21 and nearly 22. So I'd knocked on the door of the insurance company and they said politely no, that I was too young, and at that stage I wasn't even married and had no children, so they didn't think I had any stability in my life. But I continued to go back every week for the next 3 months on a regular, on a Friday at 3 o'clock, and I'd go into the office and ring the bell, and Vic Hatfield, the sales manager, would come out and say, "Hello Lloyd, I've been expecting you. I'll see you next Friday." In other words, you're still not getting a start, but I'll see you next Friday, no doubt. And I said, "You will." So I did that every week for about 3 months. And then finally, Vic, being the good soul that he is, he decided that he would turn a blind eye to my age and he would give me an opportunity to start, which I did. And so, from there, it evolved.
So when you got a no, you kept going back. So perseverance, going back and ringing the bell with Vic and saying, "I'm here again. Can you give me a chance? Give me a chance." So you seem to be someone that doesn't like taking no for an answer.
No, it's just not in my
vocab.
It's not in my vision.
Not in your vision?
No.
So would you say it's important for everyone to have a vision? So you had a vision, really, what you wanted your life to be like.
Yeah, I did.
And do you think that's where your motivation came from, to keep going back and asking for that job?
Yeah, sure did. The enthusiasm. My vision was that I was determined I would be in the insurance business.
Yeah.
And my vision was that I would be able to be good at that particular industry, because it was all about people. And yeah, I enjoy people.
There you go. Okay, so you realise you have a bit of a... You had a like to people. You saw that there was profits to be made in that industry. Saw them doing well. And you realised that you weren't the right fit for it based on what they were looking for, but it didn't matter to you because it wasn't in your vision.
Nah.
So you just kept going back. So perseverance paid off, because Vic said, "Hey, I'll give you..." He obviously was testing you too, because he said, "Well, if he comes coming back, he's going to probably make a pretty good salesperson," because perseverance is important, right? In success.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
So you're about 21, 22 at this point. And what was the company you joined as an insurance salesman?
It was a company called TNG.
Okay, TNG. And tell us what happened. So what happened at that point? Just to everyone who's listened to this, we're talking about now, Dad's about to approach, and everything to this point has led him to this point, right? So it's not just like he just started, but we're talking about where he's becoming a millionaire for the first time. So tell us what, once you got that job, what did you actually do then, the day you got it? What are some of the things you did to then go and try and succeed at it? What were your results like? What happened after that?
Well, the very first day, Vic Hatfield, my sales manager, he took me for a drive, and he drove me past the cemetery. And he said to me, "Lloyd, the people that are in that cemetery never envisaged that they would be there maybe as early as they were. Some went earlier than they had planned. But inevitably, everybody would finish up there. And therefore, you know, the real need for life insurance is real. And people really should have that to protect their families in the event that they do go earlier than planned, and leave their family with at least, you know, having the ability to own their own home, and you know, have some sort of a lifestyle that, you know, from the loss of maybe a breadwinner." And it really rang true with me at that stage, because, you know, after losing my father when I was 8, and the difficult process that my mother had, you know, getting us kids to where we got to in life, was a pretty difficult job for her, and, you know, a widow with three young children, that is. So when he said that to me, I then decided that everybody needed life insurance, and I was going to make sure that as many people that I could get to and explain it to, that I would encourage them to do that. So it was something that really did, the penny dropped with me, really.
Yeah.
It wasn't just about the lifestyle of what the insurance industry was offering, but I recognised then that there was a true benefit of people having life insurance.
So what Vic did with you, he took you under his wing, So yeah, there's a bit of there's mentorship happening already. But what he's done is he's taking you out field to talk to you about the product. This is the product we have, Lloyd. This is the problem it solves, Lloyd. Do you see this, Lloyd? Do you understand it? And your background, your story with your father, Dom, I mean, you would have understood it probably better than anyone.
Yeah, it did.
And I think maybe your background probably lent itself to the fact that your story would probably inspire people to actually realize they do need that particular product.
Yeah.
And I think it just worked.
I thought on that occasion at that young age that I was destined to be in the insurance business. And it was a business that I enjoyed and a business that I loved and a business that I was really good at.
So how did you learn after that? How did you learn how to sell insurance products? What did you do? What was it like? Because there was no... Listen, there's no social media in those days. There was no telemark. There was just... There was you in the car, no mobile phone. And tell us, how did you go about selling the life insurance products to people in those days after that?
In the first three to 6 months, I would go and speak to people on an individual basis, and you know, I had a pretty good network of people I knew and friends and school friends and people I played sport with. So I'd go and talk to them and you know, show them the benefits and associated with having an insurance policy and a savings plan. And after about 6 months, at that stage, my fiance Susan, who is Lloyd's, became my wife and Lloyd's mother. Her boss in the insurance business, he worked for a company.
There goes a Harley Davidson straight past the office. You can get a bit of an idea of where we're sitting here, but keep going. So,
my future wife, Susan, she worked for an insurance company called Colonial Mutual, and her boss, Barry Condon, he was a champion bloke, a really good footballer in his day, a great insurance man, and a real good person. And I'd have a beer with Barry Condon occasionally because my fiancée was his personal secretary. And Barry and I were at the pub one afternoon, and he said to me, "Lloyd, I know that Susan's told me you're in the business with TNG. I wish you would have come and talked to me. But be as it may, I'm here to help you. What can I do to help you?" And I said, "Well, I'm enjoying the business a lot." And he said, "Well, why don't you think about going around talking to large employer groups?" And I said, "Well, can you do that?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "There's a thing called group selling." And I didn't understand what group selling was at that stage. And so he mentored me through the process of what group selling is. So I went back to my own company and said, "Do you have these groups in place with these large employers, like the State Rail Authority and Electricity Commissions and Telecom?" Well, in those days it was Telecom, now Telstra. And to my delight, my sales manager said, "Yes, we do." And I said, "Well, I'm going to go and start talking to those larger employment groups, and I'm going to see if that I can talk to their staff in group situations," which I then became specialised in that area. And I would go right around the country, New South Wales, and eventually the whole state, and then eventually interstate, and I'd talk to those big companies.
So what you learnt here, if we can get this right, is that you learnt that it was inefficient with your time just to be talking to individuals, so business to customer, face to face, and you realised through a catch up with Barry at a local pub that it was more efficient and better to sell to large groups of people at once than it was to sell individually, right?
Well, I worked it out that it'd be like, if it took an hour and a half to do a good quality presentation, that it'd be better if I was doing it to 20 people rather than just one.
Yeah, it's 20 to 1. So you get 20x your leverage in your time.
And it proved to be that was a very successful model and a successful formula.
Yeah, and I think, so it's called the one-to-many approach now these days. But in those days, as Dad said, it was called group selling. So you can see here, Dad, it's funny, you learn, like, okay, well, that's a good, but I can be more effective. So someone gave you the idea, right, through your network, which is Barry. You went back to your employer to ask for the opportunity. They said, "Yes, we do have that." You've gone into group selling, and you realize you can do a lot more with your time selling to more people at once. So were you a little bit, like, how did you learn how to do group selling if you had no experience? Like, were you scared of public speaking? How did you set up the meetings? Like, these are the details of how you do it. So what happened then? How did you do that? How did you learn that?
Well, I remember Ron Barassi saying many years ago, perfect practice makes perfect. And I just worked on the principle that the more I spoke to, the better I would become and the better presentation that I would do. And when I talk to groups like that, I'd get a lot of questions at the end of the presentation. And most of the time I knew the answers, but not all the time. So it was a continual process of learning for me as well, that I could take to the next presentation. And then I worked out how to get referral-based opportunities. So the employer that I'd spoken to and the general manager of any particular organisation, I would get him to make a phone call to his counterpart, you know, in another location or another region, and I'd get a personal knockdown saying that, you know, the work that I'd done in his area and his section, people were happy with, and then that they would then afford me the opportunity of going and talking to
I thought maybe a Scotch would loosen Dad up, but he's being far too professional here. What he's trying to say is he would visit a school or a police station or an employer like Telstra and so on, and he would get to know the person in that particular estate, like in the police station or the sergeant arm. You introduce yourself, you learn his name, and then you'd actually ask the fellow, who is the other person in charge at the other police station?
Correct.
And they'd tell you his name, and you'd then go to that one and drop that fellow's name, and then that'd get you rapport and get you into the centre of influence, I think. Yeah. So you were wanting to talk to the centres of influence who had control or influence over the potential customers and groups of people, the employers, right?
Yeah.
Employees. So there was a craft to that you picked up in the field.
Well, it's interesting, in the police area, at one stage I had, New South Wales had 11,000 police, and I had 2,500 to 3,000 of those police as my clients. And I'd walk in and out of police stations, like in those days you could, the security was very different. And, you know, a lot of the people actually thought I was a police officer because I'd spent so much time in police stations and I was around them all over the place. And I had a lot of, you know, police as clients. And after a while, you pick up some of their jargon, the way they talk and the way they think and so on. So, you know, I sort of probably, they felt that I was part of their scene, so to speak.
So when you start talking like them, you know, and you pick up some of how they talk, there's obviously a lot of common ground and trust and rapport built human to human when someone, when you're talking the same language. It's almost like you pick up their language when you're hanging around, right? So Arnie Helen told me that, and I saw her last, said that when you were with TNG, that you would get on a pair of railroad boots or you get a book, like a manila folder, and put on their railroad insurance or something like that. And you would go and jump on the buses where all the railroad employees were riding the bus, and you would just jump on the bus and they would see the manila folder that you're a partly in the railroad doing insurance with the boots, and you would write them all up on insurance policies on the bus. Is that true?
It is. I did that with a lot of different industries. BHP was an example where I'd have a BHP folder with all the applications in it for insurance, and I'd walk around with an ID badge on with my photograph and my name and the company that I was with, and people just look at the badge, they wouldn't look at it closely, and they probably just always thought that I was part of the BHP team.
So now we're getting into the juice here, because if you've ever seen the movie Catch Me If You Can, it's very similar. So in these days, it was just, you could just, you know, you could find yourself in organisations, and I think it was just about being very, I would say crafty about getting in front of people, because it would have been hard with unions and stuff to talk to people in large employment establishments. So just picture this. I think there was a story where one of the colleagues, Dad Selthrough, told me the story, but he said that he was in BHP once with the white coat on that they used to wear. He used to walk around the white coat. And he said on the loudspeaker, they said, there's a couple of insurance agents walking around the establishment. Could just be a little bit careful. They don't work here. And you two are in there, and you or him were signing up someone on a policy while that went on the loudspeaker, and they didn't even realise.
Yeah, that's right.
So this is back in the 80s. There was no... this is just how things happened back then. But
I went into Liddell Power Station one day and I spoke to the general manager, and he decided that he wasn't going to allow me to go in. So I walked out a little bit despondent and I started walking towards the car, and I remember hearing the stones under my feet crunching, and my mind was racing, and I did a spin and started walking back, and my colleague said to me, "Where are you going?" And I said, "Well, if the general manager of Liddell Power Station is not going to let me talk to their employees, I'm going to go and talk to the union heads about getting permission to talk to their members. So I went in and spoke to the chairman of the union at Liddell Power Station. There were seven different unions associated with that power station. And I said, look, the general manager doesn't want me to talk to their the employees. I believe that this insurance policy and savings plan is good for your members, and I'd like to seek your assistance in getting permission to talk to those people. Would you be happy to do that? He said, not only would I be happy to do that, I'm going to make arrangements with management and we'll call a stop work meeting until they agree to do it, and then I'm going to let you use my office and I'm going to send people to you two at a time. I stayed in Liddell Power Station for 36 hours solid, and Jeff, my colleague at the time, Jeff Brown, he and I signed up in excess of 100 odd policies for people who are working in that industry.
Thanks for joining us this week on the Money Grows on Trees podcast. If you like the show, you might want to check out our book, Money Grows on Trees, which you can find at LloydJRoss.com. Subscribe to the show on iTunes, leave a review, and feel free to reach out to Lloyd on Instagram at LloydJamesRoss.